Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Granger understands that you go to great lengths and sometimes heights to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello and welcome back to the Sunday Podcast, presented by SportsShoes.com. I'm Ollie Lum.
And I'm Matt Seddon.
Every Sunday we get together with a guest from the distance running world,
giving you an insight into the lives and training of some of the UK's best athletes and coaches.
You can listen to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and all major podcast streaming services.
You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Sunday Podcast, where we post about our past and present guests, host giveaways, and much more.
Thanks for tuning in. We hope you enjoy the episode.
Yeah, welcome back, guys. This week's guest, great to have him on, is GB International Neil Gawley. Neil's got a PB of 335 in the 1500, 146 in the 800, and he's recently set personal bests of 748 in the 3K and 1334 in the 5K this indoor season. So we're really excited what he has to do this coming year.
Welcome back, everybody. Another week done. Goodness, another week closer to the National Cross. I think by the time you're listening, it would have been quite the crazy weekend in athletics. We've got... Well, we'd have started off with the Paul 5K on Friday night, and then, you know, we've got the BU Valentine. I'm pretty certain there's going to be some filthy times run. I'm going to predict now, so by the time you're listening, it would have been and gone, but I'm going to predict a sub-13-minute 5K by at least one, if not a few, of the Bowman athletes. Watch out for Mark Scott, obviously British interest there as well. There is other Brits doing it as well. I think Coleman, I mean, to be honest, the start list is just stacked. So you'll find out all that on Sunday by the time you're listening to us, probably. But look, let's get down to the deck. Guest this week, Neil Gawley. Cracking guest, awesome guy. And, you know, firstly, we kind of kick off. You've probably seen already, if you haven't, he's an Under Armour athlete. So congratulations for him for signing with them. He's currently based in Flagstaff full-time now, permanently. So he talks about that, and he talks about actually someone who has only just in the last year or two dabbled with altitude, and happened to be that he's only been a Flagstaff as well. So he'd never actually been to altitude until like a year or two ago. So he kind of talks about discovering the benefits. And if anyone, you know, there's probably quite a few people out there who haven't been to altitude before and thinking about going, he's quite good at, you know, letting us know kind of the adjustments he made in his training program and stuff. Because, you know, Flagstaff is quite high as well, 7,000 feet. But look, you know, he talks, obviously, a Ben Thomas athlete, and he was probably one of the first Ben Thomas athletes who really kind of got the recognition and the kind of the success we were kind of drawn to being British. So he'd been with Ben Thomas for pretty much 10 years, which is an incredible amount of time to be with one coach, as many of you know. And so he really talks about their relationship, what Ben was like. Ben, a little bit about Ben's background as well. Obviously, we now know he's at Oregon. And Gawley, unfortunately, isn't coached by him anymore, but he's, you know, he's reaping the rewards out in Flag. He's still under a little bit of guidance from him. But so we touch upon all of that. And most importantly for me, we really touch upon Gawley loves to race, you know. Obviously, unfortunately, injury put him out of the Olympics this year, but I wish more athletes did this. He made his intentions clear this summer, where he wants to be, what he wants to do, what he wants to be running. And he's kind of put himself out there on the line. I wish more athletes would announce exactly where they're going to be, what competitions they're going to be at. He wasn't shying away from mentioning like a 1K time trial and everything like that he was up to. So, and I really do, you know, I really do admire that. And I think that's exactly what the sport needs. So, yeah. Credit to Gawley for that. And of course, you know, as usual, we just delve into the past and, you know, what kind of runner he is, where he hopes to improve. And, you know, openly he admits he needs to work on his strength maybe a little bit. So look, as always, enjoy the podcast, stay safe, and just keep running. And like I say, we're going to keep churning out these guests for you. Hopefully you're enjoying them. Take it easy.
Neil, first off, just welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you on.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Appreciate it. Yeah, we good to chat to you folks.
Yeah, no problem. We just want to start off with the excitement, I guess, of 2022. There's loads of champs going down. You're currently out in flag. What's the plan for you kind of this time of year? And are there any things you're kind of aiming for mainly this year?
Yeah, it's an exciting year. It's not often we get a championship so stacked together like this. I think, I don't know, maybe some people are a bit intimidated by it, but I kind of like the idea of how tennis and golf have it, whereby there's kind of four major championships this year. Certainly in the Commonwealth, with it being World Indoors, World Outdoors, Commonwealth, and then Europeans. It's kind of almost like a sort of four major year. Which excites me really, because competing's the fun part. I mean, you can train as much as you like, and training is obviously necessary to perform, but the competing's the fun part. So I'm looking to compete in just about any of those championships listed that I've listed. So make it into sort of four majors per year type deal. I'd love that in the future, but obviously it's just because of the backlog from COVID. But no, it's absolutely exciting.
Well, that's exciting to hear, actually. I'm sure a lot of people would be delighted that you're not sort of picking and choosing. You want to be at all four.
Yeah.
A major championship performer yourself. But like earlier in the year, a little bit of a time trial. I say early in the year, just before Christmas, wasn't it? In a rare 5,000 meter outing. So talk us through the thinking behind that a little bit, and why you took to the 5,000 meters pre-Christmas.
To be honest, it wasn't in the plans at all. It was just the fact that I'd been up here the month of November, and really I'd had consistent training since July. I was sort of coming off an injury at that point, but was trying to rebuild from the injury, and really had a consistent build up since August. I came up here in November to Flagstaff, and training had just gone really well. And there were people in Flagstaff at the time that were sort of talking about doing this 5K race that was coming up in Boston on that track there that's known for being pretty quick. And I honestly kind of thought nothing of it at the start. The whole plan was just to kind of train through and really just get strong. But the training had been kind of going so well that I thought, why not? I might as well test it out and see where I really am at, because you don't really find out as much as you know you can be in decent nick. You don't really find you put yourself on the track against other people. I just decided it was actually literally the week of the race. You know what? Why not? Why not give this a bash? I'm not naive in that I know I need to get stronger if I'm going to compete over how quick some of these 1500 meter races are going in championships. It's no longer the case where you can just kind of leave it into the hands of tactics, what have you. Fast closes used to be the norm in 1500 meter runnings. We're kind of moving away from that. So I'm not naive enough to think that I don't need to get stronger. I do. So a 5K is a good measure of that. And as I said, was in good shape and was pleasantly surprised that, I was maybe even in better shape than I thought running that 5K.
Yeah,
what was it? 32nd PB, so.
Yeah, it was really good, 13:34. And it's interesting, you say you need to get stronger. I know Whiteman's come out and said, he wants to focus on sort of 3Ks and 5Ks and get stronger. You guys are like pure, 1500 meter specialists, and you're really good at it. And how much stronger do you think you need to get to sort of be on that level that we're starting to see now?
That's a good question. I mean, the two guys at the top right now, I think it's pretty fair to say, are Chariot and Jakob Ingebrigtsen. And I'm not actually sure what Chariot's run for 5K, but I know he's a 13 flat type strength guy. Mm. He'd be able to do that. And we know Jakob's gone under that. So, yeah, I mean, that's kind of almost what it takes now. Now, it's not a 5K. You've got room for being more of an 800 end rather than the 5K end. That's, people have different blends of ability. But no, it's definitely taken, at least I would imagine, it's a good question, but I would imagine at least sort of 13:20 5K shape to even be in the conversation. I would say, in terms of strength. Now, whether you've run that as a PB or not, that's another thing. I mean, not many 1500 meter runners are running a lot of 5Ks, but that's the kind of strength that's required, I think, as a minimum almost at the moment.
Will you attempt another 5K?
Might. It wouldn't be until early season outdoors. Right. Maybe do a 3K indoors. That would be good. A 3K is a good test of the sort of over distance fitness. I'd like to do that. But then early season outdoors, if we have time, yeah, perhaps.
Didn't you run, I think you already ran a quick, it was during COVID, wasn't it? A time trial, 3K indoors.
Was 3K, it? Yeah.
It was pretty much solo as well, but I remember being with James West at the time and he was like, crikey, Neil's just done this. and I was like, wow, that's pretty impressive,
It's part of the reason that I'm going to be spending about more time in Flagstaff, because I seemed to come off it really well. That was another time that I'd come off it really well, and unfortunately there were no races at all. That was kind of peak COVID at that point in time. But yeah, I think I ran 7:51 just in a sort of time trial, which that was a complete shock. I didn't know I was in that kind of shape. Because felt really great doing it, and to be honest, was just a time trial that my coach just said to, you know, be controlled, and it just ended up running a lot quicker than I thought. The altitude does seem to make a big difference to me when I come down, so it's something I'm going to use more of, and it's something that it's definitely a big tool in the arsenal for getting stronger.
What is it about Flag which is seeming to work for you at the moment, then, which you're just enjoying and getting a lot from?
I don't have much of a frame of reference for other places at altitude. I mean, Flag is just kind of the place I've used. Right. I haven't been to Font, I haven't been to Boulder, I haven't really been to San Moritz or anything like that. Flag's just what I've used. But Flag itself, you know, is 7,000 feet, so it's about as high as you'd want to go for training. Any higher would probably be really challenging. And it's just got endless amount of trails to be running on. Mm-hmm. You kind of never get tired of running any particular place. You've got so many options. And from Flag, what's quite nice as well is that you can drop down as well. You're not too far from Sedona. That's at about 5,000 feet where you can go do sessions there. You can even, if you want to, like soon, I think I'm maybe going to do a 1K time trial in Phoenix, which is a 2-hour drive away. Mm. And that's completely sea level. So you can come back up after that. They're just good options from Flagstaff. And you can rely on the weather mostly being pretty good too. You see, in complete contrast to growing up in Glasgow, you see the sun every day. You don't see the sun at all in the winter in Glasgow. It doesn't happen.
Mm. Look, obviously, you mentioned being in Flag at the moment. We just wanted to find out, what's kind of your current setup with training? You're coached by Ben Thomas still. But what's your kind of setup in terms of who you're training with? Obviously, you have OTC for a period. Is that still the case, or are you doing something a bit different now?
Yeah, no. I was sponsored by Nike in the past, but no, I've moved on from Nike. It's not with them at the moment. It's not an exclusive yet because nothing's confirmed. But I've been working a lot with Stephen Haas's group in Flagstaff with. The intention at some point maybe to sign a contract. Under Armour have been really supportive so far, and they're making really good movements, I think, in terms of funding this group that's here. Good movements in terms of getting behind their footwear, which they seem to be really coming around on. I know that's such a hot topic these days. It's strange that you know, the shoes are such a hot topic in this sport, but they're actually making real strides in having a competitive shoe on the track, and they've already got a pretty competitive road shoe as well that some people have been racing in. So I've been encouraged by that. That's not kind of an exclusive yet because I haven't officially signed anything, but the setup here is probably more where I'm going to find myself from now on.
Does that mean you've sort of left Ben?
I've left Ben. In order to stay in kind of Eugene, Nike tends to be the kind of dominant force, but we couldn't figure out anything with Nike, so no, I've had to leave Ben, and now I'm still going to get some support through him, like still going to be able to call him up and ask for advice. But no, Stephen Haas is going to be from now on sort of more my full-time coach. and I've learned so much from Ben in the past, and he's just brilliant. You know, some of the younger athletes that he's got just now, and some of the ones that have just gone pro, the likes of Cole and Cooper and James West, and these guys are so lucky to have him. And I've been lucky to sort of have his guidance for the past 8 years. I just kind of know his training inside out almost at this point, just like we know each other pretty well. He's just been brilliant with me, and hopefully I can still have his support sort of going forward, because he's very smart in the sport. And I think that shows with the guys he continually has coming through. It's quite impressive how consistently his top athletes are dominating in the NCAA at the moment.
I mean, yeah, you'd probably call him the best, like, 1500 meter coach in the world. I mean, there's certainly a case for it.
I'd argue it, yeah. Certainly in the US.
And then yourself as well, you know, we were going to ask you about that. It's almost his longest standing athlete, weren't you? Because I was thinking, you know, back in university days, surely no one's been with him as long as you have. So we were going to, you know, talk about, you know, what it was like to be coached under him and some of his training. And will you carry that forward even into Haas's group now?
Yeah, I certainly hope I could. It's not a case where I'm sort of changing coaches, and Haas has been very understanding about this, and just completely want a fresh start, that kind of thing. So it's not really what I'm looking for. There's a lot that I know works for me. There's a lot that has been ingrained into me, and as I said, 8 years of being coached by Ben Thomas. I mean, I came to him in 2013 at Virginia Tech, when he'd had some good athletes, but maybe not, you know, on the national stage quite yet. And there was a good group around me, certainly in my sort of year group. I feel like we raised the level a bit. It's one of the things that I think people don't get about Coach Thomas, about Ben, is that he's so much about all the stuff around training. I mean, if you're not getting your eating, your sleeping, whatever, right, these are the things that he's really emphasizing, to be honest. And he's good at instilling that sort of culture. It's still got to come from within any particular college team, and it's something that we had strongly at Virginia Tech. It's something at Oregon that's is pretty strong too, but just guys wanting to win. And that sort of passion comes from him. If enough people really want to win, they'll make the right decisions in and around training. And that kind of stems from him a lot.
Mm. Now, it's interesting you say that, because we actually spoke to Ben Reynolds, who's a freshman at Oregon.
Oh, yeah.
He was saying very similar, just about the things around training.
Yeah.
You highlighted there kind of the importance of having a team that all want to succeed as well. Talk to us about kind of Haas's group and the things going on there in terms of the goals for the group, I guess.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I'm certainly big on, you know, joining a team. There's got to be a good culture there, because it can sort of go either way with when you set up a group. If everybody's really supportive of each other, and everybody really wants to work towards the same goals, and everybody's got proper ambitions, good things can happen. And equally, if there are people sort of dragging down here or there, you know, equally a bad culture can happen. But I've been really impressed by it's kind of a lot of fresh faces this year in the group. They've sort of had a bit of turnover since last year, and I've been impressed with the culture in general. I've actually got two close friends of mine, Diego Zarate. He's a 1500 meter runner at Virginia Tech, so I was with him a couple of years, and then Fitz Seum, a steepler, who's joined the group as well, also from Virginia Tech. So there's a bit of a pipeline going almost. But those two are kind of familiar faces. And then there's other sort of new faces, like Casey Neville Bard. He's just run a big 5K PB going 13:24. And just people that, yeah, really want to get better. And on the daily basis are kind of, you know, showing up with a good attitude. And that's the main thing for me if I'm joining the group. It's not so much like, oh, what's this athlete's PB? What's, you know, do I get to work with this guy that's run this time? It's more, you know, are they showing up every day with the right kind of attitude towards training? Because that's what can kind of make or break a team's culture, is the sort of daily small things that you don't even notice so much.
I just wanted to ask about Virginia Tech and why you why you chose to go there in the first place. Yeah, because a fairly kind of, I would say back in 2013, a school not many people would have known much about.
Yeah, no, that's definitely fair to say. It was actually a funny story about that. I'd collected a list of about 20 colleges. I wanted to go to the NCAA. I'd seen what the likes of Chris O'Hare had done. He was a sort of pioneer in that respect for me. Like, I wanted to go out and follow that route. And I was actually messaging him about that yesterday, just because he's come out with that retirement announcement. I was messaging about that. Like, he really paved the way for me. I thought, no, this could be a really good route. So I had messaged about or emailed about 20 colleges. I had a whole list. And was seeing kind of, that's kind of how you see who gets back to you. Some people will, some people don't. And Virginia Tech weren't even on that list, I'll be honest. It was actually, I was doing an internship at the time. And I was an engineer doing a sort of little internship before uni. And one of the people I worked with, one of the sort of senior employees said, have you heard of Virginia Tech? I've heard good things about them because the sort of good engineering uni in Glasgow, Strathclyde, had a sort of, what do you call it, a sort of exchange program with Virginia Tech. And he'd heard good things, basically, about Virginia Tech. And I said, oh, no, I haven't heard about them. I'll maybe, you know, look them up. And when I heard about that, I was thinking, oh, Virginia Tech, it sounds like some kind of, you know, engineering-focused college that will be absolutely useless when it comes to sport. And I thought, oh, yeah. Very good. So anyway, I do look them up, and you know, I was looking at the stats of the guys they had, and they actually had some good guys at the time. One guy, Michael Hammond, had just finished fourth at the NCAA championships, but it wasn't so much that, it was the improvement of the guys that were at Virginia Tech that just absolutely stood out to me. Lots of athletes were coming there, you know, kind of middle of the road athletes in terms of, you know, when they were recruited out of high school. It was all Americans, really. There hadn't been any Europeans so much go out there yet. But just looking at the PBs when they got there and the PBs when they left, it just started to really impress me. And email, you know, I choose to train, that kind of thing. And I just really liked what he was saying. And he had me out to visit really soon after that. I just liked how engaged he was and how you know, committed he was to trying to get me onto the team, because some other schools, you know, it varies. Some of them are just kind of lazy and say, you know, here's the application, whatever. Mm-hmm. But no, he's really engaged, and I really liked what he had to say about training, and it really fit with regards to, I was you know, wanting to pursue mechanical engineering, and they had a good reputation for that as well. So it just ended up being a brilliant fit. More than that, it'd be the decision I ever made, because I got just the best experience there, and happened to do it under, you know, one of the best coaches there are anywhere. And at that point, it was a bit under the radar. You know, not many people had heard of Virginia Tech, but by chance, I had.
Yeah,
and it certainly worked out.
Well, there, if anyone listening doesn't know, you should watch them on game day on a football game, because haven't you got like one of the best walkouts ever?
Oh,
the traditions. Yeah. So the entrance
for Virginia Tech football is called Enter Sandman. It's just, quite literally Metallica, Enter Sandman. And it's absolutely brilliant. The whole stadium's just bouncing. It's 60,000 people for home games.
Man.
And they sell out every time, and it's unreal. Yeah, no, a good atmosphere for college football. We're not great right now. We used to be, you know, national title challenging team, but the fans are still the same way. It's a bit like, you know, a struggling Premiership team. They still got the fan base, but not quite the same success on the field.
Yeah, it's good to hear, mate. But look, on that was a bit of a side note, but back to like Ben, can you let us know his background a little bit then? Because we all know the amazing things he's done, you know, lately, and obviously at Virginia Tech and Oregon, but how did he kind of get into the sport and become almost the coach he is today, do you know?
He's quite an interesting backstory. I mean, he really worked his way up from the bottom. He ran for Virginia Tech back in the 80s. I don't want to get that wrong and age him more than he is. 80s? Yeah, must have been 80s. And was just, you know, passionate about the sport, but he had to sort of work his way up from the bottom in terms of coaching. I mean, he was taking part-time jobs sort of on the East Coast of the US. Started off in high school, I think, coached at some smaller schools like Bavard and then Appalachian State for a while. The schools that you wouldn't have heard of so much, and just kind of worked his way up. He had a couple of athletes do really well under him. A woman you might not have heard of, she's American, Mary Jane Harrelson, was his kind of first professional. She did really well under him, just while he was still coaching at the sort of smaller schools. But his dream was obviously to work at Virginia Tech, because that's where he'd gone to college. And came up through that route. And he's a little different in the way he approaches things, I suppose. And he doesn't really care what other groups or other coaches or other, you know, people are doing. He's got his own ways, and he sticks to them pretty rigidly. He's someone who likes control over everything, and he sticks to his principles, and you don't kind of get to say, I don't like this or I don't like that. You know, if it's not if you're starting to complain, then you're probably out the door. I mean, he's very accommodating, but at the same time, like, if you're not willing to buy in, then it won't work with him. He's got his sort of system, and it works really well. I mean, when people buy in, you just see the results of it. And although he is, you know, quite passionate and tough as a coach, away from that, he's a really sort of personable guy, and he takes a while to warm up to you sometimes, because he's, you know, he's sort of that way of being a coach, just quite quiet, quite reserved, but he really warms up to you when he gets to know you. And I think, you know, it's like some of the best managers in football, you hear stories about, it's like the best managers kind of, you want to play for them, if that makes sense. So he's someone you always kind of want to run well for, because it would mean a lot. He just has that kind of presence, I suppose.
Yeah. Do you think some coaches are a bit too soft?
Probably, yeah. I haven't worked with too many. But that's approach, I think, works for me. The sort of harder to please, get shit done kind of approach works for me. I don't like being babied and being told, oh, you can maybe do this if you feel good, or maybe you can do this if the weather's right. Mm-hmm. The plan is the plan, and we'll stick to that as long as as long as we're healthy and as long as things are going well. I much prefer someone giving me a kick up the backside when I need it, and someone who's actually willing to say, no, this is how I want things, rather than being almost too accommodating, put it that way. So, yeah, to answer your question, I kind of agree that some coaches maybe are, but that approach, to be fair, works for some people over others.
Yeah, I was going to ask that next. I was going to say, do you think, you know, when you reach the top end of the sport, that real sort of elite end, does that kind of softer approach just go out the window? And we don't see it as much, but you kind of just already answered it.
Yeah, no, I think it's still present. But as I say, different things work for different people. A lot of people like to be told how good they are every day, and be, you know, let them decide what they want to do on a day-to-day basis and have their feet kissed. But that's just not what works for me, put it that way.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's when, you know, I couldn't imagine ever, like, sort of coaching myself or being self-coached. I think that's an incredibly hard thing to do. But I guess those are the sorts of people who prefer to have a lot more say in their programs. You know, so on that note, I mean, at the moment, is Haas designing the programs for you?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not getting away from what I've done in the past, but yeah, no, I'm absolutely joined in with Haas's group, which has been great, especially when I'm up here in Flagstaff. Like, it's, the work here is a bit different than the work at sea level, so. There's always kind of people coming in and out of Flagstaff, professional athletes, because it's such a sort of strong scene of people that want to come up here and train. So I've been working under him, and it's been working well so far. We did kind of a hybrid type thing in November as well, before I'd run that 5K PB, and that had worked quite well with me jumping in with some of his stuff and doing some of the things on my own. I'm a little bit I'm more sort of meeting on the day-to-day basis with these guys now, but yeah, it's been working. And Haas is really good about, you know, setting certain things, but he's good about being flexible. If I know certain things work around training, I mean, he's not going to go and change what has been working for 8 years. Mm-hmm. He's smart like that. So no, things have been working well.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk us through what that looks like kind of in week by week at the moment? What are you sort of doing day to day? Like how often are you running with a team? How often are you training on your own? Like what session days, etc.?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's kind of typical of the US. Certainly when I'm in Flagstaff, the sort of session days are Tuesday and Friday. That's pretty typical of a lot of groups that come here as well. For whatever reason, those seem to be the holy days in the US. But splitting Tuesday and Friday up, I think, is pretty important when you're 7,000 feet like here is. You need that kind of extra recovery time. I'm used to someone who's more used to maybe working out maybe more three times a week, but two times a week up here is plenty, because it takes a bit longer to recover. So Tuesday, for example, this week we were doing kilometer reps, and we actually went down to Camp Verde, which is about 3,500 feet, to do that. So 8 kilometer reps, pretty, you know, pretty boring, pretty normal stuff. But it's, you know, it's the stuff that's got to be done this kind of time of year. And then so Wednesday, Thursday tends to be your kind of easier days. Friday, this particular Friday, I think we are doing a bit of a track session in Sedona. So that's looking like it's going to be a few sets of 600, 400, 300, 200, which will be my kind of first time getting on the track and getting a bit more specific with it, heading into the indoor season. So it'll be interesting to see where the body is for that. It might be a bit of a shock, but that's fine. It needs to happen at some point. And it'll vary week to week, but Saturday at the moment is long run. For me, that can be about 15 miles at the most, to cap off probably about an 80, 85 mile week when I'm up here. But the sessions themselves will vary. Like I know next week, I think we have hills planned for Tuesday. Hills are something that were an absolute staple of Coach Thomas's training, and I want to keep that in. So we're doing hills next Tuesday. Some long and short hills. It's a kind of blend. And I think next Friday, for example, we've actually got a 1K time trial. We're going to go down to Phoenix and do that. So that'd be quite good. A good little rust buster to set up for some indoor racing soon enough, hopefully.
Yeah, I mean, have you got any races in the pipeline, or you just kind of have to wait and see what kind of, I mean, there's loads in America that you can kind of tap up, isn't there?
Yeah, yeah. We're kind of waiting and seeing on the US ones. There's a possibility I'll open up on the weekend of the 28th of January. But right. Because I was maybe a week behind where I probably needed to be, I had a little calf niggle over Christmas. We might just push that back a week. And so it might be the case of running New Balance Indoor Grand Prix. There's a meet at BU again, I believe, on February 12th. So those two are probably looking like I would do those. And then we've got penciled in at the moment to come back after that, come back home and do Birmingham two weekends in a row with the Muller Grand Prix and then the British Trials.
Mm.
So that's, it'll be kind of a, you know, a quick 4 or 5 week sort of intense little block of racing in February, but I quite like it that way. I quite like it to be all kind of work together like that, just come in fit and then let the racing take care of itself.
I guess it's kind of replicates your college career as well, doesn't it? It's what you do when you are in the NCAA. Will this be over like 1500? Yeah. Will this be over 1500 as well then, I suspect, right?
Yeah, I'd like to do a 3K. Whether that will work out or not, we'll see. More likely, if I race the weekend of the 28th, it would be nice to do a 3K to sort of test myself over distance. But mainly, the focus will still be on the 1500. Yeah, I'd like to do something under distance as well. I feel like the best preparation for doing a 15 is doing an 800. So I'd like to have that in as well. But we'll see. The end of season is so short, obviously, that you don't quite get the same number of chances to compete as you would outdoors. So we'll see what we can squeeze in. But even if it needs to be an 800 that's more of a time trial than an actual race, we'll see. But yeah, the focus will be on competing in the 1500 in Birmingham at that Grand Prix and then the trials. That's the plan at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Look, it's interesting you mentioned the 800 because Matt and I were actually chatting before about, we were quite surprised how, I guess, not to say it's slow, but on your 800 PB compared to some of the finishing speeds we've seen from you in a 1500. Do you mind talking us through that? I guess you haven't done one in a few years either, though.
Yeah, I'd done one. My PB's from 2019, sort of midway through the year in a sort of heavy block of training. 146 low, I think. But yeah, no, it's something that definitely needs to come down. It's something that will come down if I did it at the right time. I think 2019, for example, if I'd raced an 800 around the time of the British Trials or Doha and something like that, I'm sure it would have been more like 145 or 144. But you know, your PB is what it is until you break it. It's all good me here sitting here saying that. But no, I think that kind of under distance speed is there. I would just need to do it at the right time. I think I'll need to be running at least 144 to be competitive the way the 1500 is at the moment, not only in this country but on the sort of global scene as well. So hopefully we can bring that PB down soon. I think some of the sessions I've done leading into major championships will maybe indicate that that's possible, but until you do it, you can't say anything about it.
But there is a difference between kicking at the end of a 1500 meter race off of maybe a slow pace through 800 than a difference just having flat out speed, isn't there? And that's the ability you seem to be probably one of the best in the world at. I remember, I think we were in Flagstaff, and I remember asking Whiteman about you, and I was saying, and he said that you closed the quickest 200 over the whole season, I think, at the British Champs. You had the quickest split, you know, in any 1500 meter race for that last 200 meters.
Could be right. I don't know. Jake obviously knows better than me. It's a different skill is closing. And this comes back to Coach Thomas a little bit. What we practice so much is not necessarily just doing certain reps at certain paces, which is important to an extent, you know, doing 400s in 52 or whatever it needs to be. It's more, we'll do perhaps maybe 300s where we cut down every 100. So we'll start maybe the first 100 in 14 seconds, second 100 in 13 seconds, last 100 in 11 or 12 seconds. It's sort of practicing changing gears. And it's a skill that I don't think maybe enough people realize is important. Although you can run fast from the gun, that doesn't necessarily mean you can cut down. And it is a different skill that you actually need to practice. It's not like I'm just born with it. I'm really not. I've worked on it a lot, changing gears. And that was something I definitely want to keep in going forward. And it's something we'll keep in. It's one of my favorite sessions to do is do 300s where you're cutting down, focusing on finishing quick. As opposed to just, you know, you could go run a 300 and it could be 38 or 39 seconds or whatever, and that would be a good session. But can you do it starting slow and finishing quick? And there's a skill to that. So it's something that I think, has given me a great benefit in races. And it's not just something that I naturally have, I don't think. It's something that I've worked on a lot. And you can be good at it naturally. Don't get me wrong. There's obviously talent involved, but I'm not naive to think that. But it's something that we've worked on a lot, put it that way.
I think, it's good to hear because I think a lot of people just kind of, they picture you and they just think, oh, he's got an incredible finish. And I think it's reassuring that you have spent years and years working on it.
Yeah. I didn't used to have an incredible finish, that's for sure. No, I used to get past in the last 100 all the time. It's something I've worked on.
How much confidence does that give you going into some of these big championship races? obviously you mentioned 2019, where you're talking about earlier, you had a fantastic season that year, and it seemed like you were almost unstoppable if you were there with 100 to go.
Yeah, plenty of confidence. I mean, it's a kind of joke that every 1500 meter runner thinks they have the best kit, but they're wrong. They're all wrong. I do. That's the kind of joke. it gives you confidence to know that there's sometimes an extra gear when you're going into that last 200, that last 100. I mean, there's no guarantees. Like, Jake Whiteman is certainly not someone who I'd want to be anywhere near with 100 to go. He's got wheels that just about everybody would be jealous of. So it's really just a case of, and some of it isn't just a case of having those wheels. It's a case of positioning and tactics as well. Like you mentioned the British champs. I just kind of got that right tactically. Jake Whiteman could easily have got that right tactically and beat me. He didn't do much wrong, but it's just fine margins at that level. And, you know, you see it all the time. People will win races one week and then get beat the next week just with similar margins, just because of small decisions that you make in any one race. Now, things are changing a little bit in that races are being run from the gun quite a bit more at championship level. So those tend to be a bit more predictable. But it's something that I'm working on. And, you know, I'm not just trying to get to the level that I was in 2019. I want to be a lot better than that. And if I'm to be a lot better than that, a lot of the gains are going to come over this kind of aerobic side of things. I've got no kind of interest in getting to the level I've already been at. Improving, you know, every day is what I'm all about. So I'm more than intending to be better than that this year. And hopefully, you know, staying injury free, that'll show on the track. But I don't like just saying, oh, I'm going to be this and I'm going to be that. I'd rather go and do it. So hopefully I'll go do it this year. We'll see.
I'm sure you will, man. And the podcast is going far too well. I think we need to talk about, obviously, last year missing Olympics and being injured and what it was like watching.
Talk about watching, the low points. They're important.
Yeah, watching the boys sort of go out there, you know, Kerr doing the business and performing. But run us through, like, why it was you couldn't compete at the British Champs last year and you had kind of a rough summer being injured.
Yeah, it was a rough time. I mean, I've probably been quite lucky in this sport that I've never had any major injuries. But what I have had now is probably an injury at the worst time I probably could have had one. In the spring, what happened was that I came off the European indoors and got COVID, as a lot of the athletes in that team that went to European indoors did. It was a risk of going. I mean, I knew that. I don't really regret it. It was an opportunity to compete, and you got unlucky, if you want to call it that. It wasn't that unlucky. I mean, it was rife at the time, and lots of athletes on the team got it. So I ended up getting COVID while representing the country there, out in Poland. That was the European indoors. So that hit me quite hard. Was out a few weeks until I felt like myself would run again, and you know, was fine. This was kind of pre when you could get vaccinations, so it hit me pretty hard. I wish it had happened sort of after I got vaccinated, but that's your luck. Started trying to get back to running, and things are going quite well actually into April, and it was almost things were going too well, and I just got a bit complacent, and I was rushing because I knew I had to be fit in time to run the Olympic time. And I was pushing the training back up a little too quickly. And doing that is kind of a recipe for disaster. All I was focused on was, are my lungs okay? And is my heart okay? Because I'd heard all sorts of heart stories of people struggling after COVID. And that was all good. And I got a bit carried away and with the training and, landed up with a calf tear that we kept getting better. We kept sort of rehabbing it to the point that I could probably do a session and kept getting it to near enough healthy, and I would have a setback. So there were sort of three or four occasions where I thought I was kind of out of the woods with this, but the soleus is kind of notorious. That's some poetry there. The soleus is well known for sort of, you think it's fine and it's not. and we would do something that's just a little too quick for it, and it would just pull again. It would just snap on me. And it was kind of dramatic like that, where I'd be fine one second and then I'd just have to like pull up and hobble in training and, you know, limp home. Oh. And there was kind of one final session. I think it was about 10 days out from the Olympic trials. And at this point, I hadn't even raced yet. But, you know, we were close and we weren't actually unfit because we'd been able to do parts of lots of workouts and we'd been able to do a lot of work on the Alter G, you know, doing sort of, you know, 90% body weight stuff, that kind of thing. There was a session I did and I was completely on my own using Oregon's facilities. And I was on a treadmill, actually, because the treadmill was a little easier than the turns on my calf for whatever reason. And I had maybe about 10 seconds to go in my last rep. We're just doing 3-minute reps. It was kind of what I could handle at the time. And just it just popped like that in a second. And I sort of, you know, it would have been funny to get on video, but like fell off the treadmill in a heap and just was lying there sort of knowing that the Olympics was gone that second. Like it sounds so overdramatic and it sounds like a movie scene or whatever, but I was just like lying there in tears and then had to sort of, you know, hobble home and accept reality that it wasn't happening this year. And like I say, I've been lucky in my career in the past where I've not had major injuries. This was just bad timing. It happens. It's part of the sport. And, you know, you learn to live with it. And I did not make the Olympics this year, and some great athletes did from this country and performed well. No kind of hard feelings about it at all. It's just what this sport is. And I didn't get to take advantage of this opportunity, but there will be plenty more in the time that I have left in this career. So it's not all bad. I'm definitely to terms with it now.
Mm. Yeah, 100%. And obviously, we chatted earlier about how many opportunities there are this year. Talk us through kind of the rehab process from the calf tears. Were you a long time out, and how did you, I guess, build up again?
It wasn't too bad, actually. Once we decided that, you know, the Olympic trials wasn't a go, or I wasn't going to be able to make it healthy through 2 rounds if I tried, it was actually pretty straightforward. All it really ever needed was kind of a month to leave it alone and for right. the, you know, the injury to calm down. That's all it ever needed. And that's what we did. The tear healed pretty well. I just wasn't giving it at that time. I didn't have enough time to take that time off prior to trying to qualify. So we gave it that time. And the Olympic trials were June. By August, I was running again. And feeling pretty good, pretty healthy. It's just bad timing. The injury wasn't ever that bad itself. We were never worried about it affecting my career long term. It just wouldn't let me go at that particular time. So, you know, we wanted to make sure it was strong. This wouldn't happen again. Throughout the months of June, July, August, even into the autumn. But the rehab was straightforward, to be honest. This was never an injury that was that complicated. It just needed time.
There's sometimes the worst ones where you have to just try and, you know, nurse them rather than the ability just to rest it, you know. And I think that kind of highlights how hard it is to make the Olympic Games, because, like I say, it only comes around once every 4 years. And you need that element of luck on your side when it does come around, don't you?
Yeah, it's luck, and it's also like 1,000 decisions every day. I mean, I could have been more sensible in, you know, building back from COVID. I could have, you know, there was one particular thing where I paced a 5K for the Oregon guys, and I knew I really shouldn't have done it, but I thought, oh, just a little calf soreness, it'll be fine. And that was when, you know, things sort of started to spiral. There's lots of decisions every day that get you where you're going. And I've always kind of tried to err more on that side of things rather than saying, oh, it's your luck one way or the other. You make a lot of decisions every day that determine your luck. And, you know, you can be the wrong side of luck, but usually there are ways you could have done better. And I think there are ways that I could have managed this better. But you know, I made those decisions for the right reasons. I was running out of time, and I needed to get healthy and fit in time to compete for the Olympics. So there's not much in the way of regret. It's just how this sport is. It's a balance. You make decisions that you think are the right ones, even if they end up being the wrong ones. You don't necessarily need to regret them, but you know, that's just the way the sport is. I was under some time pressure.
I think you're bang on with that. I think that's the trouble with our sport. It is decisions every single day, which can kind of add up and lead you somewhere. You know what I mean? Lead you to injury, I guess, and other problems.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Good way to look at it, though, because I think, if you, like you say, if you always think it's luck, then he takes the blame, I guess. Or not blame, but take some responsibility off yourself and the decisions you make.
Yeah. A lot of people will get injured or get a stress fracture or something like that and think, oh, I'm so unlucky. Why does this always happen to me? I never actually think to review and say, what were the decisions that I made that led me to this point? Because injuries don't just happen by accident unless it's completely freak if you get hit by a bus or whatever. But usually there's thousands of decisions that lead you to an injury, and it's important to reflect on those, because that's when you learn. I mean, I learned that, you know, it's a lot better to be patient and healthy than it is to be, you know, impatient and sitting watching the Olympic trials, put it that way. You know, sometimes I don't give myself enough credit for, you know, if I take a week off and I don't run, I'm still going to be okay. I'm still, you know, a similar athlete. It's not going to set me back that much. And it's, these are the things you make decisions every day, like I said.
Well, yeah, look, I mean, we're pretty much there, Neil. I just wanted to ask, you know, why do you run? Because I think it's always a fascinating question for people. You know, what is it you enjoy about running the most? And why the 1500 meters as well?
Yeah, it's important to sort of recognize that I love my job. I talked about the sort of harsh parts of the sport in this podcast, and well, it sounds like, you know, I've got it rough. I really do not. I love this sport, and all I ever really wanted when I was younger was to compete for Scotland. I grew up watching Scottish football and playing rugby as well, and I wanted to compete for my country in something. Running is something that I found somewhere along the way, as something I was pretty talented at when I was younger, or at least somewhat talented. I wasn't that good, but got better and better at it, put it that way, and developed in it. And competing, to be honest, is why I do it. I just love it. And I think when you get that honor to represent your country and represent in doing that, the people that have got you there, the family, the friends, the people that believed in you, that's what the hell I do this for. It's not for the love of training or anything like that. It's that kind of, you know, giving back to the people that have really allowed me to succeed. Because I've had plenty of advantages in my career, and the ways my parents have supported me, the coaches I've been lucky to have. It's kind of doing it for them and competing and sort of making them feel like it's worth it. For me, that it's worth it. That's what I kind of do it for. Certainly these days is to almost to pay it back, because as I said, everything else is a bonus. Now that I've competed for my country, I just kind of want to pay it back and see how far I can push this thing when I'm competing, which is the part I really enjoy.
And you love competing. Do you get nervous? And what is it you love? Do you love, for example, I find, you know, your relationship with kind of like Whiteman and Kerr fascinating, because you guys are all at such a competitive level, but you're all still friendly off the track as well. But do you love beating those guys deep down? Is there a particular athlete you just love to
beat? Yeah. No, it is odd, because unfortunately, the likes of Jake Whiteman, Josh Kerr, you know, Chris O'Hare, that's just retired. And there's some lovely people around in this sport, and I really wish that I could hate them, but I don't.
Right.
I really wish that they were these nasty people that really get on my nerves, and that, like, I would love beating. And, you know, you do enjoy beating them, but no, they're great guys is the problem. Mm. And we all get on really well. It's an odd dynamic, but you know, deep down, when you put your foot on that 1500 meter line, that they're not friends and they're not treating you as friends either. That's just kind of the way it goes. It's a good skill to have, and I think a few of us have it, is to kind of switch off The sort of friendly side of it, I suppose, when the gun goes off, you can kind of go back and forth. But no, those guys are such such good pals. And, you know, having known Jake since I was like, you know, 10, 11 years old, it's hard to for there to be any real animosity. But the competitiveness comes from just how high the standard is. I mean, you just got to want it, and you've got to want to train hard if you're going to ever have a chance of beating guys like that.
I think that's a really difficult skill to have, like be able to be mates and then switch it on when you come onto the track, because
yeah
I mean, I'm either you can't love you or hate you kind of guy. Yeah. I do think that skill is really difficult, and that is, you know, probably what makes people successful in our sport, because our sport is a friendly sport at the end of the day.
Yeah, sometimes I do wish it was a bit more like the UFC or boxing or whatever. Yeah. And, you know, people really did at least pretend to hate each other, at least hate each other in the spotlight. It gets clicks and views, but there's something quite brilliant about the fact that you can get on with these people so well and be real, you know, when you're talking to each other, and then actually compete really hard against each other as well. There's just so much respect there that it almost drives up the similar kind of level of competition anyway.
Could you imagine how hostile a cool room would be if you, you know, hated their guts?
Oh, I know. Imagine it was 12 people that really did hate each other. That'd be brilliant. I'd love it. But it's not realistic with the amount of nice people that are around. Running's too hard a sport for people to really hate each other. It's too, everybody knows what everybody's kind of been through, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
To get there.
Talking to some of those guys like Kerr and Wyman and obviously yourself, I was just thinking Scotland could seriously clean up in the 1500 at the commies, and depending on who does what champs, especially obviously with Laura Muir and Ricky on the women's side as well.
Yeah, I mean, we've certainly just in our wee country, Scotland, we seem to have this boom of 1500 metres sort of middle distance athletes at the moment. I don't think I can pinpoint it on anything particular. Because we all kind of come from different backgrounds training wise, and we all have kind of gone different routes. But I don't know. There's a certain mentality that I think the likes of Laura, Chris O'Hare kind of pioneered, and that, you know, we can compete, and not just because we've done X, Y, and Z, because we really bloody want it bad. And kind of not willing to take no for an answer. I think quite a few of those guys, like Josh, have that attitude, just not taking no for an answer, really. And if there's any sort of common link between the sort of success of the sort of Scottish 1500 meter runners, it's probably that. It's just that mentally they're kind of ready for anything. And I think, you know, the likes of Chris here was a big pioneer for that. I know I learned quite a bit from him watching him race. Laura as well, just so tough, and just not willing to sort of give in to anybody or anything on race day. And yeah, as for, you know, their success, like I was, you know, believe it or not, really happy to see Josh win a medal at the Olympics. Although it was hard to watch the race itself, it actually made it a lot easier to watch seeing him win a bronze medal, because, you know, is someone that I've been close with, good pals with. So it's good that I could sort of separate, you know, the frustration of watching that final from actually being happy for a mate that just achieved a dream.
Right. Well, I mean, yes, bloody hell, Scotland could go 1-2-3. I'll be cheering for everyone, but Scottish athletes at the Commonwealth Games.
That's gonna be some field in the Commonwealth, actually. When you look at what the Australians can put out now, when you look at what England can put out now, when you look at what obviously Kenya can put out, and you've got Jake Hayward representing Wales as well. So it's and Pierce as well. Shit. Yeah, it's gonna be some race.
Yeah, man. But look, I mean, that's pretty much it, mate. Cheers for a brilliant podcast, man, and giving us an insight into Neil Gourley. Who you are.
Not at all. Thanks for having me on.
Best of luck for indoors, and then obviously the rest of the season as well.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Ollie. Cheers.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths and sometimes heights to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.